as we study your word and consider its application to us, I pray that you would give me the words to say that will be edifying to your people. Pray that you would give us all the hearts to take in what you want us to respond to and to be responsive to you. I pray that you would give us the courage to get up and do the things, to return to doing the things that you've called us to do when we have strayed from that calling. Pray that you would give us the love and compassion to lift up our brothers and sisters who have gone off track and are needing to be restored. And I pray that you would give us the perseverance to keep trusting you and be found faithful when Jesus returns and we are glorified with him. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Well, to recap the context of the passage we're studying today, King David's son Absalom has staged a coup, and David has fled across the Jordan River to the walled city of Mahanaim. Then Absalom took over the capital city of Jerusalem, mobilized a huge army, and came across the Jordan River to kill David and his followers, wipe them off the face of the earth. But in a surprise reversal, Absalom instead was killed and his army retreated. Now, David's soldiers are trudging off the battlefield back to Mahanaim, or running, as was the case with the one guy we looked at last time. And they're going to regroup with David and their families inside that walled city. But instead of being greeted by a commander-in-chief who's handing out medals and congratulations, the first thing they hear when they approach Mahanaim is David above the gateway weeping because they've killed Absalom. So that's our context, and I'll start in at 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 1. Presently, it was communicated to Joab that the king was there weeping and mourning over Absalom. So the deliverance became a mourning occasion for all the people on that day, since the people heard it said on that day, the king is grieving over his son. So on that day, the people stole in, entering the city like when the people steals in ashamed when they fled during the battle. And the king himself was covering his face, and the king was crying out with a loud voice, "My son, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son." So Joab went to the king at his house and said, "Today you have put to shame the faces of all your servants, the very ones who have delivered your life and the life of your sons and your daughters and the life of your wives and of your concubines. As a result, loving those who hated you and hated those who love you. For you've managed to communicate today that there are no officers or servants who belong to you. Indeed, I understand today that were Absalom alive and all of us dead, only then would it be right in your eyes. Now get up right now, go out there and speak to the heart of your servants, for I swear by Yahweh, there is no way apart from you going out there that any man will stay the night with you tonight. And for you, this could be worse than all the evil which has come upon you from your boyhood until now." So the king got up and began officiating in the gateway. And they communicated to all the people, saying, "Look, the king is officiating in the gateway." And all the people came before the king. Meanwhile, Israel had fled, each man to his tent. But all the people throughout all the tribes of Israel were trying to come up with a verdict, saying, David the king has brought about deliverance for us from the grip of our enemies, and it was he who rescued us from the grip of the Philistines. Yet now he has fled from the country on account of Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we appointed king over us, has died in the battle. So now, why are y'all keeping quiet about initiating the return of the king? Then David the king sent a commission to Zadok and Abiathar the priests to say, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are y'all being the last to initiate the return of the king to his palace, since the verdict of all Israel has come into the king at his house? Y'all are my brothers, you're my bone and my flesh, so why be last to initiate the return of the king? Also say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God deal with me thus, and even more, if you do not become general over the army in my presence all my days instead of Joab. So he inclined the heart of all the men of Judah like they were one man, and they sent a commission to the king to say, return, you and all your servants. Then the king began the return and came up to the Jordan. And Judah went toward Gilgal to go call on the king in order to bring the king over the Jordan. I'll stop there. There's a lot in this passage about comebacks. There's the people of Israel and Judah who have to decide whether they want David to come back as their king. There's David mourning in his house over the death of his son, yet he has to come back to the gate to celebrate his army's victory. But first, there's the return of David's soldiers to Mahanaim after the initial battle. Here they had risked their lives in an almost hopeless last stand to defend David, their king, and bring an end to Absalom's despotic and murderous actions. And yet, when they had finally succeeded against all odds, they returned to their base only to find that their king is upset with them, even though they had done what was best for the country. David, don't you realize what would have happened if Absalom's army had killed you? How can you be sad that we didn't get slaughtered out there on the battlefield? We won, for crying out loud. Why should we have to sneak back into our own city like a bunch of lily-livered greenhorns who'd run home from the battle crying for their mommies when the battle started? Absalom deserved worse than he got. Would you quit moaning about it already? What are you thinking? Of course, you can't say that to a king. So you just slunk in and found the apartment that your family was occupying and started figuring out what you could eat for dinner. No victory parade, no cheering crowds, not even a slap on the back. And Joab was watching how discouraged the troops got from this and how this weakened David's position to lead the nation. And he decided to do something about it. He decides to call David to make a comeback. Now, Joab's tone is not as respectful as it should have been, but he did have a unique position to be able to speak to the king. He was the army general, and he was also a relative of David. He had the standing to speak to David. And even though his tone was sharp, he was warning David about a true emergency. Couldn't wait another day. His sharpness could be overlooked due to the urgency of his message. And he's actually following Jesus' advice from Matthew 18, verse 15. If your brother happens to sin in regards to you, David's just insulted me and my soldiers, go lay out a case to him between you and him alone. That's exactly what Joab's doing. If he happens to heed you, you'll have gained your brother, said Jesus. So notice, Joab doesn't confront David in public. He went to the king at his house. So there's a private setting. He lays out the case to David that David has sinned by dishonoring the men who had risked their lives to protect him. And he calls David to come back, to return to the role that God has given him as king. Now, we might have a hard time seeing how that was actually a sin that David did, but in their culture, shame and respectfulness were a much bigger deal than they are in our culture. And so for the king to ignore his men when they had returned home in triumph and to instead mourn over what they had actually done, that was a serious affront. It was as much as saying, despite the fact that you showed love to me by saving my life, I hate you. In fact, you're all court-martialed. I no longer recognize you as my soldiers. I wish you were all dead. And that hurt. Joab helps David to see how offensive his behavior was. Sometimes people just don't realize how offensive something they did was. And you've got to let them know. Just go to them privately and tell them how they offended you. That's what Jesus calls us to do. And Joab also points out how dangerous it's going to be for the entire kingdom for David to alienate his people like this. And to further underscore the urgency of his message, Joab swears in the name of the Lord. Now, it's hard to tell for sure, Bible commentators were kind of on both sides of this issue. Perhaps this oath was a threat that of Joab saying, I am going to defect with all the troops tonight if you don't do this. If you don't snap out of it, David, I'm going to defect with all the troops. Or maybe, and I'd like to think, he was just describing how fragile the loyalty of his troops was at this point. If you don't do something today, then by tonight, you're not going to have an army left. You need to act immediately. If you don't give them a reason to stick around here in Machanaim, they're all going to go back to Jerusalem or wherever their farms and families are, and they're going to go on with their lives, and they're going to write you out of their lives and find someone else to be king, David. They're already starting to leave now, because you've not made them feel wanted here. You've got to do something. Get up right now. Go out there and speak to the heart of your servants. If you don't snap out of this and do everything in your power to make a comeback right now, you're going to lose big time. Just speak to them, though. I know you can win them back if you'll just get up and do it. Sometimes we need to hear that kind of kick in the pants from a friend. Don't we? When we get stuck in our heads, Proverbs 27, verses 5 and 6 says, open rebuke is better than love that's carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Now, doesn't necessarily mean that it's being a friend to always be rebuking and criticizing everybody all the time. But are you able to be that kind of a friend when they need it? The result is that David gets up and sits in the gateway. The Hebrew verb is literally sat. But that's what community leaders did back in those days. The gate was where the elders of the city sat in order to do their job of judging legal disputes and deciding how to lead the community. Sitting was a position of authority and leadership. Joab's exhortation then was successful in jogging David out of his morose fit and getting him back in the game and to fulfill God's calling on his life to be the king of Israel. So now, the people have to decide to support David's comeback. Are they going to do that? Over the last several chapters, the people, that Hebrew word, ha'am, has usually meant David's soldiers. And for that reason, the NIV has often translated that Hebrew word as David's men or his troops instead of people. So I think that the people referred to in verses 8 through 10 are the same soldiers who supported David, and that they're rallying to David and then dispersing throughout Israel, the northern tribes, to make their case with the men from Absalom's army, who had already returned to their homes, to bring back David now as king of Israel. And their two main talking points are, Absalom is dead. Don't have a king. Might as well bring back the old one. And second, David did a pretty good job when he was king. Remember what he did in defending our country from all our enemies? He, you know, why not bring him back? He was a pretty good king. Now, this took some grace on the part of David's soldiers. They had just been insulted so badly that they were about to mutiny. So they had to first forgive David for his inconsiderate behavior towards them. And then they had to decide to trust him again as their leader before going on a political campaign for him in hostile territory. But they did it. The decision whether or not to rally back to a leader who's done something wrong doesn't always have to be positive. It takes wisdom. Whether it's a husband who has sinned against his wife, an employer that has sinned against his employees, a pastor, or in the case here, a political leader who has sinned against his people, there are circumstances when a leader should be rejected. But there are circumstances where the leader should be extended grace and given the opportunity to try again to do better. It takes wisdom. I can think of three considerations, and maybe there are more, about deciding whether or not to support a leader making a comeback. One would include whether the nature of the offense was such that it could be overlooked. If I commit a murder, you can't overlook that. You can't support me anyway. I have to be punished for that. In this case, though, David had merely insulted his troops. He hadn't committed really a crime. It was perfectly understandable that David, as a father, was experiencing emotional conflict over the execution of his son, even though it was needful and just to execute Absalom. His offense could be overlooked. We can support a leader who has offended us if it's something that can be overlooked. Another consideration, if it's a serious problem, is whether it's likely to happen again or whether the leader is truly repented. In this case, it was unusual for David not to support his men. This was just an outlier for him. He seemed to be responding well to Joab's rebuke. He was back on the throne doing what he's supposed to do. So it was reasonable to give him another chance. It did not appear that he was going to keep doing this. If I repented of teaching a false doctrine, you've got to decide, well, am I likely to keep going into more false doctrines in the future? If so, then you should not accept me staying, in leadership. But if it looks like, no, I really understood that I got down the wrong path and I understood what was wrong and I'm responding well to that, and I'm not likely to keep doing that, that's the second consideration. The third consideration is, what's the risk? The amount of risk which giving a leader another chance, is that a risk you can take? If David's sin had been idolatry or treason, that might have been too great a risk for the country to be willing to accept and had taking him back. Might have been better to find another king, and if it had been idolatry or treason that he was leading the people into. But in this case, the risk was probably just the king might get temporarily sidelined by grief again. He might have another week of a weeping fit. That's a risk we can accept for the sake of national stability to get the old king back in. So David's men went on the campaign trail, and they built a consensus among the northern tribes of Israel until the northern tribes said, yes, let's bring the old king back. But what about the southern tribe of Judah? It was there in Hebron that Absalom's rebellion had been hatched. It was there that Absalom had worked the hardest to undermine trust in David. Would they want David back as their king? The next verses describe how David won them over. He decided to work through the high priests. These church leaders were respected. They were close to God. They were stable. They hadn't fled the country. And they kept their connection to the people. But of course, David knew their sympathies were with him, and so he could count on them to help. Who do you suppose was commissioned with this message for the high priest? I bet Ahimaaz was like, me. David asked the priests to talk to the elders of the tribe of Judah. The elders, he wanted the message directed to them because the elders were the community decision makers. They were the ones who held the people's respect. They were the ones who had anointed David king in the first place. Back in chapter 5, if the elders could be persuaded, the rest of the people would follow. So David appeals to them in language that reminds them of their covenant with him back in chapter 5. They told him in their covenant ceremony, we are your bone and your flesh. So David puts their words back to him, reminds them, you're my bone and my flesh. He reminds them of their own covenantal words to him. When we bomb out and lose our credibility due to the foolishness of our own sin, David shows us the way forward with these two principles. Who are the authorities in your life that you need to reconcile with to show them your respect? And what covenant promises have you made in the past that you need to return to and keep? Who are the authorities you need to reconcile with? That's especially relevant in resolving conflict in the home with your parents, or on the job with your boss, or in the church with your elders. We need to reconcile with those in the leadership. Reconcile with your authorities. And the second, what covenant promises do you need to return to and keep? That's especially relevant with marriage failures. To return to honoring your marriage vows. But it also applies to work contracts, church membership. Return to keeping your promises. And part of David's appeal is also that he was a relative. David was from the tribe of Judah. He's appealing to the elders of Judah. It's only natural for them to support their own kin. Hebrews chapter 2 reminds us that our own Savior and King Jesus shares kinship with us as Christians. He was the one who makes holy. And Hebrews 2:11 says, the ones who are being made holy, that's Christians, are all of one kind with the one who makes holy, that's Jesus, on account of which he is not ashamed to call them brothers. Children have shared flesh and blood. He also similarly partook of the same things in order that through death he might put out of commission the one who had the power of death, that is the devil. There's a lot of typology between David and Jesus. Kinship is just one of those things. The folks from Judah, however, were probably wondering if David was going to try to punish them for supporting Absalom's uprising against David. They're probably hanging back, afraid of what David might do once he got back in power. David's message encourages them that there's not going to be a political witch hunt. If they step forward in support of him, he's going to treat them like family. When you move to restore a broken relationship, people are going to watch to see if you can forgive them for the hurt that they've done to you, or whether you're just going to hold grudges and try to get revenge with them if you continue in relationship. If David hadn't reached out to the elders of Judah with his message of reconciliation, he might have wasted the rest of his life out there on the East Bank for the Judeans to make the first move. As Mark Travers pointed out from the Gospels at our church retreat, Jesus teaches that whether you are the offender or the one offended, just go ahead and take the initiative to go and reconcile or be reconciled. Whether you're the offender or the offended, go be reconciled. Matthew 5:23 gives that command to the offender. Matthew 18:15 gives that command to the offended person. The last part of David's message was to tap Amasai, Absalom's army general, as the new commanding general of the new united army. Now, this move may have been motivated by several things. For one, it made the statement that David was in power, not Joab. Joab had been the leader on the battlefield, whereas David hadn't even shown his face. So some people may have been begun suspecting, and David was getting on in years. He was an old man at this point. Maybe people were suspecting David had become a puppet under Joab's control. But David here is asserting his own leadership. David also knew that the nation was still in a fragile state and could easily split. So he wanted to quickly put into power a man that the northern tribes could trust, and that was Amasa. It couldn't be Joab, because Joab's murder of Abner a few years before probably still didn't sit well with the northern tribes. They would have had a hard time trusting their lives to Joab's command. A third reason, perhaps, that David tapped Amasa as the new general was to punish Joab. Joab had acted expressly against David's orders by killing Absalom. And David had to come up with some way to give Joab some kind of discipline for that. So a demotion was in order. David's message to the elders of Judah and to Amasa succeeded. It won the hearts of the nation, and once again, Israel was united in supporting David as king, and they encouraged him to come back to Jerusalem. And that's where we end the story for now. David moving out of the walled city of Machanaim, traveling down the Jabbok River to the east bank of the Jordan River, while the representatives of the tribe of Judah are winding down out of the Judean hills from Jerusalem eastward towards the Jordan River lowlands to the west bank of the Jordan River, just past Jericho to that nice flat campground of Shechem. Can you imagine then, as Dave, this is a photo actually of the Jordan River at one point. Can you imagine what a huge encouragement it was for David as he came up to the east bank and looked out across the river to the west bank and saw this crowd of family and friends cheering because they wanted him back? If a family member or a friend or a coworker has bombed out and is struggling to get back on their feet, look for opportunities to encourage them. Welcome them back like the people of Judah did for David. Hebrews 3:12 says, "Keep watch, brothers, otherwise there'll be in some of you an evil heart of unbelief, apostatizing from the living God. Rather, encourage one another throughout each day, as long as it's called today, in order that some might not be hardened among you by means of the deceitfulness of his sin. Don't be the last to encourage a Christian that is struggling to come back and follow Jesus. As David waited for his people to desire him as their king, here's another model that David presents of Jesus's kingship over the church. Like David, Jesus is perfectly capable of using force to require immediate submission of all his subjects. David could have swept into Jerusalem with his army and killed a bunch of people and said, "I'm king now." But he didn't do that. And Jesus could have done the same thing on the cross. Remember, he said, "I could have called down tens of thousands of angels to just wipe you guys out." But he didn't do that. He's chosen to win the hearts of his people and let our expressions of faith in him as Savior and Lord be what marks us as his subjects. It's a marvelous picture of Jesus' own relationship with us as our King. Well, I hope you're already making applications to this, to your life, with this theme of making a comeback. One application is to return to your own God-given calling when you get sidetracked. When you've done something great that you think deserves praise, like David's soldiers coming back triumphant from battle, but for whatever reason, your boss or your mom and dad get upset at you instead. You thought they were going to praise you and they got upset with you instead. Are you going to just quit trying to do what's right? Are you going to write those important relationships off with your mom or dad or your boss? Or are you going to put out the effort to overcome the offense? Or when you've become overwhelmed like David was by an emotion, maybe anger that made you do something stupid, or depression that kept you from doing what you should have been doing, or some other strong emotion that derailed you from doing what you should have been doing, are you going to wallow in that emotion and allow it to take control of you? Or will you take your thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ and return to your mission, whatever it is that God and your authorities have tasked you to do? Maybe it's shame. When you've sinned and you're so ashamed of that sin, you don't even want to show your face again. Are you willing to confess your sin to God and to the affected parties? Ask Jesus to rescue you and open up yourself to being forgiven and loved anyway by God and by God's people, the church. That is what God calls us to do when we sin, not to hide in shame, but to confess our sin, open ourselves up to being forgiven and loved. Now, God might have to send a messenger to call you out of a preoccupied state. That message might not be easy to accept. Joab's rebuke of David was uncomfortable. Will you pay attention when a friend or a parent or somebody rebukes you? Will you be willing to listen past their irritating manners to the friendly concern for you that they have in their heart and their desire for you to get right again? Will you humble yourself and just thank them for bringing the problem to your attention instead of biting their head off for not doing it the best way they could have? Another application is to help others when they are trying to make a comeback after they've blown it. You can be a Joab with a kick in the pants rebuke. Get up, go out there right now and do what God's called you to do. James 5:19 says, "Brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone turns him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." You may need to do some kind of a rebuke to save somebody's soul. Another way we can help others is by being like David's people, who overlooked and forgave an offense that was committed against them. They gave David time to come around and then rallied behind him when he stepped back into the saddle. Hebrews 10:24 says, "Let us be considerate of one another to provoke them to love and good works, not leaving out the gathering together of ourselves, but instead being encouraging, and so much the more while you're seeing the day getting close." Encouraging, being considerate of our brothers and sisters when they need a helping hand or an encouraging word. My final application is a little different, but it relates back into the typology of David symbolizing Jesus, and that is that we have a king who, like David, is coming back to take his rightful place as king on this earth. Are you expectantly waiting for his return? We don't know when Jesus is coming back, but he's told us it'll be soon. Are you looking forward to that? Are you willing, looking forward to dropping whatever you're doing when you see him coming through the sky, and excited about just dropping whatever you're doing and running to him when he comes? Jesus has also told us that there are certain things that need to be accomplished before he returns. David's followers had campaigns to fulfill in Israel and in Judah, messages to deliver to key people in order to win their hearts over to want David to be their king. And similarly, Jesus has commanded his followers in Matthew 28:19 to go make disciples of every people, every nation, every ethnic group. And in Matthew 24:14, he said, "This good news of the kingdom will be announced in all the world as a witness to every nation, and then the end will come." Jesus expects us to complete this mission of making disciples in every people group in the world before he comes back. Now, there are people it used to be part of my profession to do the sociological calculations of development of the gospel in every people group in the world. And I have gotten some distance from that. The Joshua Project website that we put our unreached people group information on the screen from, they are leaders in that science of studying people groups and studying how many of them are reached with the gospel. And I don't know if we can, I'm not sure we can actually nail it down completely exactly, but we do know generally this is what Jesus wants us to do and what he expects to get done before he returns. The good news of the kingdom will be announced in the whole world for testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. And so let's be faithful to hasten the return of our king by participating in that mission, winning hearts with the good news of Jesus, finding ways to expand the gospel into more people groups around the world. These are lessons I think we can apply from this little passage about David coming back after his exile in Machanaim. Return to your God-given calling when you get sidetracked. Help others make a comeback. And hasten the return of King Jesus yourself.